It's Morning Edition from
We're making a list. Republican Vice President Mike Pence, Democratic Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, and other members of the House and Senate, U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams, CNN's Sanjay Gupta, even actor Sir Ian McKellen, and Great British Baking Show judge Prue Leith. We could go on. All of these people have shared photos or videos as they've received their first shots to protect against COVID-19. We're spending the hour on a conversation about those vaccines here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Kate Archer-Kent. Your questions are welcome at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We're taking your questions about the vaccine, taking your experiences, if you are a healthcare worker or someone who has received their first dose, or questions about how it will all work and the difference between the two vaccines that have been approved by emergency use. 800-642-1234, or you can also email ideas at WPR.org. Mary Haney is a pharmacist and a professor in the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. Her lab studies responses to vaccines, particularly in immunosuppressed patients. Mary, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much.
And Dr.
Glad to be here.
Oh, certainly. And Dr. Nasia Safdar is Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. She's on the faculty at UW School of Medicine's Division of Infectious Disease. Dr. Safdar, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Let's start with those visible vaccinations. President-elect Joe Biden is set to get his vaccine on video today. Vice President Mike Pence received the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. Here is the vice president talking about it. Actually, we don't have that little bit of audio. He just said that this was an historic week and really hinted at this hope idea. Dr. Safdar, how important do you think it is that we see and hear from leaders or, you know, even actors as they get vaccinated?
Oh, I think it's a critical thing. You know, this is a game changer in the way that the pandemic will unfold. And so the more people that get the vaccine and to encourage trust and belief in people that this is the right thing to do at this time, the more visibility we can bring to it, the better it will be.
And Mary, Pence received a shot. What are the primary ways of administering COVID-19 vaccines at this point?
Right now, both the vaccines that are available are administered by intramuscular injection, or an injection into the muscle in the upper arm. Those are done by healthcare providers, and it's a routine, you know, almost every vaccine is administered, including your influenza vaccine.
Yeah. And what have we learned about the effectiveness of Pfizer's vaccine? That's the one that's actually here in Wisconsin right now.
The Pfizer vaccine in clinical trials was very effective. I mean, I'm thrilled with the results. The results were greater than 90% effective in preventing symptomatic COVID disease. So, I mean, that's just fantastic. That's really high-level protection among our best vaccines.
And how many shots does one person need to be fully protected? And then what happens if you don't get the full number of shots?
Well, we don't know. Let's start with you need two doses.
Yes, two doses.
Both vaccines, because, you know, the other vaccine was authorized by emergency use authorization over the weekend. Mm-hmm. So both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines will soon be used, because the Pfizer one has about a week head start. And it is administered in two doses. You need both doses. We don't know what happens with one dose.
Okay.
So
yeah, this is also new. Yeah, so get both. Mm-hmm. Appreciate the advice. We have Cindy in Appleton ready, who has a question related to this. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. I'm just wondering, because I was going to ask you, just kind of answer my question, that we need two shots. But the point is, if you get the Moderna shot the first time, are you able to get the Pfizer shot the next time? Do you need to have the both from the same company? And why actually do we need a second round? I guess I'm just curious as to why we even need that. And if you can, you know, switch from one company to the other, and how are they going to keep all that straight? And are they going to have enough of this and that and the other thing? So that's my question.
Yeah. Cindy, thank you for bringing that up. And Mary, where do we start? There are a lot of questions here.
Yeah, there are, and I appreciate that. Ask those questions, get the information you need. The vaccine should be. Each individual should get the same vaccine, the same manufacturer vaccine. And for the most part, I think early on, you will only be able to have the same vaccine because each vaccinator will only have one vaccine because it's just not going to be as widely available as we would like. When you get vaccinated, you'll be given information about how to get your second dose. And in fact, a dose will be reserved for you to get your second dose so that it will be available. You want to get the same vaccine because we don't know the effectiveness if we mix vaccine preparations. They're quite similar, but nevertheless, let's do it the right way. So you'll be given a card. You'll be given strategies to get back for second dose, how to get that second dose, and when to get that second dose. So, although healthcare providers will take some responsibility for giving that information, each individual who gets vaccinated needs to take this on as well and make sure you come back for that second dose. And every arrangement and strategy will be put in place to get you back for dose two.
We're talking with pharmacist Mary Haney, who researches vaccination and other protective effects. And we also are speaking with Dr. Nasia Safdar, who's the medical director of infection control at UW Hospital and Clinics. And we're taking your call as we discuss COVID-19 vaccines here on The Morning Show. You can call 800-642-1234. Are you one of the people who's eligible to receive a coronavirus vaccine sometime soon? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Maybe you're not on the short list and you have questions about how to make sure that your family stays safe and the effectiveness of vaccines. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Safdar, do these vaccines make someone completely immune to the virus?
You know, they are extremely effective. So as Mary mentioned, in the clinical trial, they were 95% effective, which is remarkable. I think that, nothing is 100%. And so even though good as they are, I think that there will be some individuals, and we'll know more about that as people start to get vaccinated in larger numbers after these trials. But there will be some people who will not be able to mount an immune response to the vaccine, which is to be expected. So even though they are remarkably good, it's not 100%.
And that sounds like that would be the case for more people getting the vaccine, because then you're able to develop some sort of herd immunity. Is that fair? How does that work, Dr. Safdar?
That's correct. I think one way to protect people who cannot get vaccinated because they have a contraindication such as, a major allergic reaction, or their immune system is such that there's concern they may not be able to mount the antibody response. So to protect such people, those around them, if they're vaccinated, that would be a good strategy. And that requires that at least 70% or more of the population get vaccinated.
Do we have any idea when we might be able to get to that point here in the U.S.?
I think every day the situation looks better. As more manufacturers get approval and more production is undertaken, it will be a rolling start. That's why we're having to prioritize for groups at high risk and then so on. But eventually, late spring, early summer, I would think that the vast majority of people that want a vaccine should be able to get one.
We're talking with Dr. Nasia Safdar and researcher Mary Haney about the COVID-19 vaccines that some Wisconsinites are getting now to protect themselves from severe cases of COVID-19. And we're taking your questions at 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. This conversation continues this hour. I'm Keely Voltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. We have two vaccine specialists here with us on the Ideas Network, and we're talking about how that works here in Wisconsin. As we see the rollout of the Pfizer vaccine, we see emergency use authorization from Moderna and another vaccine in development from AstraZeneca. We're comparing the vaccines and figuring out what we need to know as people who are looking for an end to this pandemic. Thanks for joining us on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. This hour, we have Dr. Nasia Safdar and vaccine researcher Mary Haney, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Joe in Oconto has a question for us. Good morning, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's on your mind?
I have two questions. The first question has to do with how our cells activate our immune system. So my understanding is the mRNA vaccine enters into the cell and our cell creates the spike protein, and that spike protein is presented on the surface of the cell that is creating the protein. How does our immune system, is our immune system destroying our own cell then that's presenting that spike protein?
Okay, Joe, let's just hang on for just a minute then, and we'll get an answer, and then we'll come back to your other question. Mary Haney, help us understand how this mRNA vaccine works.
Actually, Joe, our caller, described it very, very well. Very clear description. I'm going to maybe use some of your words there. The question about destruction of the cell. When an intramuscular vaccine is administered, a wound, because, you know, a needle enters your arm. But, we don't really know about exactly which cells are being, producing the mRNA. Is it the muscle cells or the immune cells? It's probably both. And not producing the mRNA, producing the protein from the mRNA. And I need to use Joe. Joe did is doing a better job on this than I am. But it presents the protein to the immune system. So it doesn't necessarily say that the cell has to die. But rather it would allow the immune system to see this protein and then mount an immune response, similar to any immune system, any immune response that we make, say it be to a virus or a bacterial infection.
Sure.
So I made that super clear.
So the body is able to recognize it, and it doesn't necessarily destroy the cells.
Right, right.
Okay.
Because especially if it's done by an antigen-presenting cell, if it's presented by an antigen-presenting cell, that's its professional job. The cell has this job of presenting antigens or viral proteins to the immune system.
And then, Joe, you had a second question. What else is on your mind?
Yeah, my follow-up question to that was I am hearing that long COVID may be connected to an autoimmune response, and I'm wondering if that autoimmune response can be activated with greater strength by the fact that we have these antigen-producing cells or presenting cells that might be activated during the vaccine response.
Okay, thanks for the question, Joe. And Mary, let's stick with you. Can you help us understand long COVID, Joe referenced?
We know that it exists. The long COVID is people who have had the infection and have lingering symptoms following COVID, and they just don't seem to recover like you would from a respiratory viral infection, such as a cold, and they continue to have symptoms. And I think this is an area of intense study because this is very, you know, this is certainly an important public health issue, as well as it's very interesting. So I don't think I have enough information to answer that question. We know that there were people in the clinical trials who had previously had COVID, and they seemed to do well with the vaccine. I can't specifically answer a question about that subset. We just don't have the information.
Yeah, we're dealing with a lot of unknowns and not a whole lot significantly into the future. We are talking about vaccines for COVID-19 here on The Morning Show. You're hearing from Mary Haney, who's a professor with the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. And we also have Dr. Nasia Safdar, who's the Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. And next up, we have Vicki in Mount Horeb with a question. Hi, Vicki.
Good morning. My first question, I also have two, but my first question is, when someone has received the vaccine, are they still able to shed the virus or be like an asymptomatic carrier out in society? And then my second question is, what is the latest information on how long the vaccine lasts in our bodies?
All right. Thanks so much, Vicki. And Dr. Safdar, let's start with that last one. Do we know how long, if someone's vaccinated, they're protected from these severe symptoms of COVID-19?
You know, I think this is one question where there's a little bit of speculation involved, because we won't truly know that until we follow people for a long time, test their antibodies and see if there's decay over time. When we have looked at natural disease, the antibody that develop as a response to that lasts for several months. And I think it's expected that the vaccine will, you know, it may be an annual vaccine, but I think many people feel that it looks better, that it will be rather more long-lived as far as the immunity goes, which is encouraging. But ultimately, I think it will be the test of time that gives us the answer to that question.
So it really is just more wait and see. There's no way to be able to predict that except to watch how people have reacted.
Exactly.
And Dr. Safdar, what about Vicki's other question about getting the vaccine and still potentially being able to transmit COVID-19 to other people, even if you have been vaccinated? What does the vaccine actually do, and can that happen?
I think it can happen. I think people feel that chances of that happening are less likely. But that is one of the reasons why we're saying that even for people who are vaccinated, that we still have to promote physical distancing, that we still have to wear masks, at least until some months have gone by and we have a better understanding of whether there is any potential for people who've been vaccinated to still shed. I think my feeling about that is that it is unlikely that that would be the case. But again, I think hard data on that is still pending. So it would be good to not lower our guard too much following vaccination.
And let's go to Duane in Wausau now, who has a question. Hi, Duane.
Oh, good morning. All great questions. The discouraging news out of UK about this variant strain, I was wondering, like, you know, how antibiotics can be broad spectrum and, you know, that's for bacteria, but are these vaccines so specific that they will not cover even the slightest mutation if another mutation happens, is what they're reporting now? And one more thing is, a lot of people don't wear masks because they say it won't affect them. But I was hoping parents and grandparents would be talking to their children and grandchildren, encouraging them to do so. And that would go a long way to convincing younger people to wear masks. So,
all right. Thanks, Duane, for the tip and also for the question. And so, Mary, we do have news out of the UK that it seems that a new variant of the virus is responsible for more cases. And Duane is wondering, I mean, does it cover any of the mutations? How does this work?
Again, we don't know everything. And we're hopeful that any mutation that arises. Viruses are very smart. They've been around forever, and they are able to continue to cause infections. So here, let me go back to the real question of whether or not any mutated virus may be covered by the vaccine. We're hopeful that they will continue to be covered by the vaccine, but as we know, other viruses, like, say, influenza, changes every year, and we need to have a new vaccine every year. So this is a possibility with the coronavirus vaccine, but we're hopeful that mutations, especially these early mutations, will continue to be covered by the vaccine.
Do we know if the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines cover the same strains?
Well, we know that the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines cover the strains that are currently circulating because of their high level of efficacy in the clinical trials.
Okay. So while the virus may mutate more, for the most part, we're able to target to what we know COVID, or the kind of COVID that's spreading right now. Is that fair to say, Mary?
I think that's fair to say right now. We never know what the virus can do. And viruses can mutate. So my crystal ball doesn't work well enough to say that, oh, we nailed it. But I'm cautiously optimistic that, this vaccine did work in clinical trials that were done starting in the summer through the fall.
Yeah. We're having a conversation about the effectiveness and the rollout of COVID-19 vaccines in Wisconsin. Our guests on the morning show are researchers Mary Haney and Dr. Nasia Safdar. They're with us for the hour. And there's room for you in this discussion. Your questions are at 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org as we talk about vaccines and try to get questions answered at the forefront, at the very beginning of vaccinating for COVID-19. Up next is news. I'm Keely Boltina. This is the Ideas Network. Gatekeepers in the United States have cleared the way for two different series of shots for emergency use here to try to prevent and immunize people against COVID-19. And we're talking with two experts on vaccines this hour. Mary Haney is a pharmacist as well as a professor in the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. Her lab studies responses to vaccines, particularly in immunocompromised patients. We're also talking with Dr. Nasia Safdar, who's the medical director of infection control at UW Hospital and Clinics. She's on the faculty at the UW School of Medicine Division of Infectious Disease, and we are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. I want to welcome Michael and Kakana to the program now. Hello, Michael.
Oh, yes. My wife and I both have had the virus, and we're wondering about, we've heard that there could be ill effects of, we don't need the vaccine out because we've had the virus, but we're wondering if at some point we should look into getting the virus and what the negative side effects might be if we do, and that's kind of where we're at. So I will hang up and listen to you on the radio. Thank you.
I appreciate it, Michael. Thank you so much for the question. Dr. Safdar, what should people who've had the coronavirus think about when it comes to vaccination?
You know, a small percentage of people in the clinical trials who received the vaccine who had previously had COVID. And so our feeling is that having had COVID is not a reason to not get the vaccine. You can get reinfection from the virus, so it's a good idea to proceed with vaccination. There doesn't appear to be any additional reactions or adverse effects in those who've had the virus and then received the vaccine versus those who've just received the vaccine. It's also likely that there's, you know, a great deal of underestimation going on about who has acquired the virus over the last 10 months of the pandemic, because many infections are either very few symptoms or no symptoms. And so it's going to be hard to tease out whether somebody has had it or not. So I think the better part of valor is to proceed with the vaccination.
And Dr. Safdar, do we know after someone has COVID-19 how long those antibodies last?
At least several months. What we don't know is whether the levels decline enough to no longer be protective and what that level of protection, you know, what's the minimum threshold that needs to be. But we know that decay does happen, but it happens over several months.
All right. And we have more callers now at 800-642-1234. Lots of questions about COVID-19 vaccinations as it's all so new. And we're all looking to figure out how we can answer this pandemic. We've got Ray in Janesville ready to speak with us. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning to you. My question is, because I'm a little confused on the vaccine shot. My wife is disabled. She's on oxygen. She has congestive heart failure. High blood pressure, she has all sorts of issues. But my daughter is 32 years old and is a caretaker for her because I'm out here driving truck, being an essential worker. And I'm just curious on where we will fall when it comes to taking the vaccine, because for me, it seems like all three of us ought to get the shot at the same time, you know, but I don't know if that's how it's going to fall. So yep. I guess that's my question, you know.
Ray, thank you for sharing your experience and also for that question. And Mary, you're a pharmacist and you look at vaccines and you're seeing how Wisconsin is rolling out vaccinations for COVID-19. Can you kind of help us assess Ray's situation?
Yeah, that's a great question. Many people are wondering when they're going to get the vaccine. And the policy continues to evolve. And just yesterday, Sunday, the advisory committee on or maybe it was Saturday, over the weekend, the advisory committee on immunization practices put forth a new policy. Well, not a new policy, updated policy about we want to prioritize vaccinating people 75 and older would be next following, along with essential workers, would be next following the healthcare workers. This policy then needs to be considered and approved. But as far as who are the essential workers, let's face it, in Wisconsin, we might consider snowplow drivers essential workers, whereas that certainly wouldn't be the case in, say, Florida. So each state will come up with determinations as to who is next. And please know that these phases will overlap. So it's not like every person over the age of 75 and older will need to get vaccinated before the next group gets vaccinated. So, you know, please stay tuned. I'm pleased that people want the vaccine, and we just need to get a handle on what the supply is going to look like, and then hopefully keep the demand high.
Yeah. Dr. Softar, what's your take on the rolling out of these vaccines and whether someone is high risk or just because of their individual health or in a high risk category? How do you answer to some of the uncertainty that people have who are interested in this vaccine?
You know, I think in an ideal situation, if there were no supply constraints, then I think the caller was exactly right that everyone who wants a vaccine should be able to get one because they either have a risk to themselves or a risk to those that they love and take care of. And I think that will happen very soon over the next few months. But in the immediate present and future, I think what we have to do is prioritize those groups that are at the highest risk. And so it doesn't mean that others are at no risk. It's just you have to go somewhere and start with those at highest risk. And so those are people that generally are at the front lines. They're healthcare workers, they're other essential workers, they're first responders. And as Mary mentioned, there's a long list of people who are considered essential workers that are right up there. And then those people who are older and have comorbid conditions or other complications that such that if they were to get COVID, they would find it hard to recover from it. So those are the priority groups. And each state, I think, will have a slightly different variation depending upon their population, but those are the general principles.
Dr. Nasia Softar is the Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. Mary Haney is also a guest, a professor with the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, where she researches vaccination and other protective effects. She's also a pharmacist. And we are taking your calls this hour on the morning show, and we have Ellen from Madison who has a question for us. Hi, Ellen.
I have two questions. I'm in my late 70s, and I wish there would be a drug.
Oh, Ellen, I'm going to go ahead and jump in. I'm so sorry. I heard you say that you were over 70, and I know you told our call screener that you are an older individual and you worry about going into a building. So you're wondering if there's a possibility of making vaccine drive-throughs, I would assume then, you know, when we have more of the vaccine. Thank you so much for that question. I'm sorry about the phone line. But Mary, I mean, you're a pharmacist. What about a drive-through vaccination situation like we have drive-through COVID testing? Is that a potential for us?
I think it's a potential, and I think we should explore every possibility. The problem is these vaccines are stored frozen. So a drive-through would be a little bit more difficult. They're stable at room temperature for a little while. And then the other problem with drive-through is we live in Wisconsin. And so the vaccinators would essentially have to be standing outside. So I see some obstacles. I don't think that they're insurmountable because we could do, you know, other creative ways. But I have not been involved with or have specifically seen any plans for drive-through vaccination in Wisconsin.
All right. I hope that answers your question, Ellen. Yeah. We actually have Tom from Milwaukee who wants to talk about that cold storage. So let's go there. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Yeah, that's a good segue into what I wanted to ask. The vaccine has to be stored at a very low temperature, but how long can it be warmed up before? Obviously, it's got to be warmed up before it's injected. And what happens if it's left out too long, or if it does that reduce the effectiveness, or is there any other adverse effects?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Tom. And Mary, what do we know about the cold storage aspect of it?
The vaccine does require very cold storage. Well, the Pfizer vaccine does require ultra cold storage, with even special freezers. So those but they do have a brief period of time where they can be stored because they do need to be warmed up in order to be administered. There's a brief period of time, which is hours. So vaccinators have been trained and are very specifically attuned to what is that window. So we of course don't know what happens if an expired vaccine is administered, because we want to avoid that at all costs. So please know that the vaccinators have been highly trained and are very attuned to the very specific and fragile nature of the vaccine, so that they do adhere to all of the storage requirements.
And Dr. Safdar, scientists often take years to develop a viable vaccine, and yet we've seen the COVID-19 vaccine in less than a year. As we see it's being distributed, what questions are researchers still trying to answer about this?
You know, I think one important question is going to be, so we know that they work really well in trials. How does that translate into the real-world effectiveness once the vaccine is widely available and people are taking it? And so that real-world effectiveness means being able to look at the antibody response over a prolonged period of time. You know, when do you start to decay, if at all? How long do you think you will need to, you will have before it needs to be readministered? Does it work equally well in people who have compromised immune systems, such as patients who have had transplants? Does it work in pregnant women as well as it does in other populations? So I think those are some questions that we would like to get more answers to, and time, I think, will provide those. But that's the purpose of wanting to continue to rigorously evaluate these even after the trials are all said and done and people are starting to get vaccinated in big numbers.
We're talking with Dr. Nasia Safdar and researcher Mary Haney. We're exploring your questions about the COVID-19 vaccines and how the process of creating immunity from the new coronavirus is happening in Wisconsin. And we are talking about it here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Thanks for joining us here on The Morning Show. We'll get back to more of your questions in just a few moments. We are working through the science of vaccinating for COVID-19 here in this country. We are busting myths along the way and catching up on the work to develop immunity to the worst symptoms of this coronavirus disease. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Thanks for being with us. We're talking with Dr. Nasia Safdar and researcher Mary Haney, and we're taking your calls. And next up is Beverly in Brookfield. Hi, Beverly.
Hello. I have had anaphylactic reactions to eggs, and I'm wondering if or which of the vaccines I could have.
Thanks for the question, Beverly. Dr. Safdar, would Beverly be able to get one of these COVID-19 vaccines with her allergy?
I think that, you know, talking to a healthcare provider in detail about the type of reaction, when it occurred, what kind of vaccine it occurred to, and all those things would be important. I don't think it's an absolute that you can't get one of the vaccines, but just reviewing the risks and benefits, I think, would be important. The options might also be more open as we get additional vaccines approved and on the market.
Yeah. All right. Hopefully that answers your question and you're able to talk with a primary care physician about your risk and weighing what makes sense for you. Thanks again for the call at 800-642-1234. Dan from Independence called, couldn't stay with us. Dan wants to know about the cost of the vaccine once it's offered to the public and if insurance companies are committed to covering it. Mary, what do you know about that as a pharmacist?
Yeah, the vaccine is available at no cost. However, the vaccine is only part of it. There also is the vaccine has to be administered. So healthcare providers can bill insurance for the administration fee. But if an uninsured person presents for a vaccination, vaccine providers have committed to providing the vaccine without cost.
Right.
So it should be available, widely available, without a financial barrier to everybody in Wisconsin.
All right. Thank you so much for clearing that up, and hopefully that answers Dan's question. We've got Tom from Yuba who wants to share with us now. Hello, Tom.
Hello. Okay, where do I start? I am 72 years old, in disgustingly good health. I've never been vaccinated for anything after, like, measles and mumps when I was maybe, you know, 10, 12 years old. And I want to know if I should be at the end of the line, if I could hold out as the 30% that doesn't need to be vaccinated. I want to do anything possible to, you know, to be help the cause, but I want to know if there's any reason maybe I shouldn't need to be vaccinated.
Hey, Tom, is there a reason you might think that you don't want to be vaccinated? Is it about a concern that you have about the vaccine, or is it about making sure vaccination is available to people in high-risk categories? Just help us understand.
No, I have no religious convictions about it and no fears about it. I will, you know, trust the medical establishment in this country. If we were this quick about getting that virus up, we're pretty good. So I have
okay.
No problem with that. I just want to know if a person like me who has just never been vaccinated hardly, you know, really will need to be.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for clarifying, Tom. I appreciate it. Dr. Softar, what do you think about Tom's question?
We think that there's no reason for you to not be vaccinated if the vaccine becomes available. You're not expected to have any adverse reactions or any problems to it. And, you know, it's very fortunate that you haven't had any issues without having received vaccinations. But I think for this particular thing, you would want to be in line for that.
And that goes back to the point you made early on, I think, Dr. Softar, which is, you know, we need lots of people involved in this to make sure that those who can't get vaccinated are protected by everyone else. So if it's safe for Tom, then that's an opportunity for Tom to help his community.
Yes, and let me just take a moment here to add to the previous caller's question about, you know, the egg allergy. So anaphylaxis to eggs per itself is not a contraindication to the COVID-19 vaccine, but discussion of allergies of any type need to be had with your provider.
Okay. Thank you so much for that. And we are talking with Dr. Nasia Softar, who's the Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospitals and Clinics. And we are also talking with pharmacist Mary Haney, who researches vaccination and other protective effects. And Mary, even after this vaccine has been distributed, do we have any idea how likely it is that a better vaccine than Pfizer's version of Moderna's version will come along?
Here's my ideas on that. I don't know that a vaccine can be better, offer better protection, because we're at 95% in clinical trials. Now, again, just as Dr. Saftar said, we do need to see how does that translate when we get it out into the general public. But I think I'm cautiously optimistic. And well, no, I'm even going to go confident that the vaccine is going to provide good protection, even in the general public. But obstacles we have with the current vaccines is that they require frozen temperatures. So I think that might be the improvement that another vaccine might offer improvement and make it easier to store or therefore make it more widely available because you don't need these frozen temperatures. The other possibility of vaccines for future vaccines include that there might be a vaccine preparation that provides better protection in a specific subset of patients. Maybe it would be the older patients or patients who have compromised immune systems. And so we don't know what future vaccines can do. So I want to have a full menu of vaccines. That's ideal, so that we can choose the best vaccine for the situation.
Joan called from Racine, and Joan says there's a lot of rumor on the internet about how this vaccine, in Joan's case, Joan says it can alter our DNA. Dr. Safdar, is that true?
No, it is categorically and absolutely not true. There's no way that the vaccine can alter anyone's DNA. First of all, it doesn't even get into the nucleus of the cell where our DNA resides. So I understand there's a lot of rumor and misinformation out there, which is why I think that if people would select one or two major sites where we know the information is reputable and accurate, such as, for instance, the CDC website is a great source. The Wisconsin Department of Public Health is a great source to go to avoid being misled by some of these untrue things that are going out there.
Yeah, and we just have a couple of minutes left, and I want to make sure that we do a little bit more myth-busting. Dr. Safdar, what about the idea that the vaccine was created too fast and they didn't really have enough time to test it?
You know, that's also, I would say, untrue in the sense that, yes, it was created fast, but it doesn't mean that the steps that needed to happen didn't happen. The reason that I think it was fast is because a lot of brilliant minds did nothing else but this for many months, and a lot of barriers were removed that ordinarily would take months, such as, you know, the review process, such as making sure that people came together, whatever paperwork needed to be filed. So it was those kinds of administrative things that were streamlined to be able to make this a high priority. In terms of the scientific rigor, the ability to evaluate it, all those steps were done exactly as it should be for vaccines.
And Mary, what about this one that's been circulating? There might be a microchip within the vaccine.
I have heard that one too. As a rumor.
You have. Mm-hmm.
Well, first off,
someone's concerned.
Microchips aren't that small.
Fair.
Okay. These are nanoparticles that are in the vaccine. So what it is RNA coated by a lipid particle, and they are smaller than your cells. So we don't. First off, why would there be a microchip in the cell in the vaccine? I don't even understand the motivation that why would that be there? So it's a very sensational myth that is absolutely not true.
Yeah, no basis.
And impossible.
In fact, though. Yeah, right. Not just untrue, but not possible to do. So I think that helps immensely. We know that there's a lot of misinformation circulating and people have a lot of questions. Surprisingly, we've just scratched the surface in this conversation, but I so thank you for your time. Mary, we appreciate you being here.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And Dr. Safdar, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Nasia Safdar is the Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. Mary Haney is a pharmacist as well as a professor with the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, where she researches vaccines and other protective effects. We've been talking about the COVID-19 vaccines, their effectiveness, how they're different, and what that means for people here in Wisconsin. You can email your questions to ideas@WPR.org. There's more conversation about this in the future for sure. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show. And you're listening to the Ideas Network.